Thank you so much. Let's see, is this working? Everyone can hear? Good. I'm really pleased to be here and really pleased to have an opportunity to talk to you. And my topic, as you heard, is Islam in America. One of the things I can tell you already is I'm not going to tell you enough about Islam in America. And so the first thing I wanted to do, you know, I'll tell you some, but not enough. There's just, you know, not enough time, and there's more to be said, and a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is debates over pluralism and secularism and how Muslims play into that. So what I want to do first is also to recommend a really fantastic book. This is called The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf. It's by, the author is Moha Kaf. That last name is K-A-H-F. And this is a novel written by a Muslim American woman. It's a semi-autobiographical novel about a girl growing up in the Midwest as a Muslim. Her family is from Syria, and it kind of does a really nice job of tracing the variety and complexity in American Islam. Most Muslims in the United States are actually African American, which is something that a lot of people don't realize, given the attention to immigrant Muslims more recently in the news. And so one thing this book does is kind of show the different ways that Muslims from who are immigrants from different areas interact in local mosques, and there's conflicts there between immigrant Islam and African-American Islam. White American converts or Latino converts to Islam have different pictures of what being a Muslim means. So there's all kinds of interesting textured details about what this young girl's life is like growing up and kind of coming of age as a Muslim American woman. So I recommend that one, and it's also just a lovely novel. So you get fantastic information, and it's a lovely read. My students are reading it for one of my classes, and they come in so excited. They're like, we're learning things, and it's not even hard. So plug for that. And let me say a little bit more about me and about what I'm going to talk about today. I think the first thing to say is that I might get into trouble. And you all might get into trouble too, but this is a Freethinker Association, right? So that's what it's about, is seeing where ideas go and what kinds of implications they have by talking them through with each other. One of the things I'm going to talk about is my recent fascination with the debates over the Ground Zero Mosque, the inaccurately titled Ground Zero Mosque. And I'll warn you kind of ahead of time that these are ideas that I'm still fleshing out. And so there may be some things that, one, you'll need to say, wait, what? Can you explain that a little bit more? And I'm happy to do that. And then in the discussion afterwards, I'll look forward to questions that you have, comments that you have, that help me continue to think through what I'm talking about today, the ideas that I'm having about this so-called Ground Zero Mosque. When academics say things like, I'm working through these ideas, that's often trouble, because it means that, like, they might not make sense. It's going to be fun. So, when I was watching and listening to the Ground Zero Mosque debates this summer and this fall, I began to ask myself, what is my investment? How am I implicated in the struggle for Muslims to gain religious freedom in the United States? You know, what's my place in this struggle? I'm not Muslim to begin with, but I still found myself really interested and really kind of obsessed, actually, with all the circulating drama, right? And my involvement was largely symbolic. Most of what I did this summer and this fall was to forward articles to people, to kind of have conversations with friends of mine who said things I thought were crazy. I'll say more about what I think in a minute. Posted comments on Facebook. You know, that's the way that we all feel like we're doing something these days, is to post comments on Facebook. You know, newfangled things. So I got kind of obsessed with the outrageous ruses of the political theater over where Muslims can own real estate. And I began to, you know, I was really into it. And some of my friends and family members found my passion for this issue actually somewhat surprising. Now, why? Why would they find this surprising? I think they found it surprising because I'm also an out lesbian and an outspoken feminist who regularly speaks out about women's equality, issues of lesbian and gay, bisexual, and transgender justice. And for many people, the perception is that the struggle for LGBT rights and justice is something that would be pitted against a constituency that would include most Muslims. So Muslims, as mostly conservative religious folks, would not be on board with these other things that I care really passionately about, women's equality and LGBT rights and justice. So they would ask me things like, well, Islam is a religion that is oppressive to women and prohibits homosexuality. So, you know, if they were to gain kind of momentum in the United States, these ideals that you're committed to might actually be threatened. So why would you, you know, care so passionately about something that might not even, that might result in some kind of discrimination against you as a person? So these were the kinds of questions I was asking myself. You know, what kind of personal investment would an out lesbian feminist have in these struggles for religious freedom for American Muslims? And as one, a story by a friend of mine really kind of drove home this point. He's a gay man and told me about going home to visit his family this fall. And he usually kind of has it out with his brother-in-law, who's a conservative Republican who has been a staunch opponent to most lesbian and gay rights politics. So usually they're kind of across the table having warring conversations about, you know, LGBT rights. So my friend, I'll call him Jason, when he came back home this past summer, he found suddenly that he had an ally rather than an opponent. His brother-in-law came up to him and punched him on the shoulder and said, hey, you know, we're on the same side for once. I say we should let them build a mosque near Ground Zero when they let us build a gay bar, or when they let someone build a gay bar in Baghdad. Like, we're on the same side. And my friend was just more than a little horrified because he lives in Manhattan and is quite, you know, supportive of the community center that is being built in Lower Manhattan. But this story kind of speaks to the way that there are many people who assume that gay people in particular might have reasons to oppose the increasing presence of Muslims in American public life. It speaks to the assumption that gay people and others fighting for what we see as sexual liberties, kind of secular sexual liberties, have political interests at odds with the struggle for Muslim religious expression and inclusion. So, you know, there's this idea that that these rights movements are not natural allies, that folks fighting for LGBT rights and justice have investments in a kind of secularism, in less religion, right, governing their lives, and that groups like this group of Muslims in New York have an investment in more religion. So how is it that someone like me finds it necessary to be involved in both of these areas? I have a simple answer and a complicated answer, and I'll start with a simple one. The simple answer is that I believe that standing against injustice is just the right thing to do. And kind of regardless of where the chips fall in the aftermath, Dr. Martin Luther King has famously argued that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And it would seem to me that, you know, efforts to bar American Muslims from the rights guaranteed to all Americans is simply unjust and should draw the concerns of people everywhere who are committed to justice. So that's the simple answer for me, is it's the right thing to do. As I give it more thought, I also think, though, that there is a more complicated answer to that question of why I'm invested, why I, out lesbian feminist, find the struggle of Muslims for religious freedoms so compelling. And thinking through that reason means countering the perception that those of us who are committed to secular liberty, committed to freedom from religious intrusion in private lives and government-sponsored activities, those of us committed to secular liberties are necessary at warring sides with conservative religious constituencies, and especially religious minorities. I think, actually, this is the claim that I want to try out on you all today. I think that gay people, kind of my shorthand for LGBT people, gay people and Muslims might have far more in common than most people might think. So this talk is largely an effort to explain to you why I think this is, why gay people and Muslims are involved in interconnected political struggles. And since I'm here among freethinkers and humanists, I'll broaden that because I think you're involved with this too. So not only gay people and Muslims, but freethinkers as well is a constituency that has also been active in pressing for freedom from religion, and kind of shares a similar orientation with LGBT, mainstream LGBT rights, as well as overlap between those two, right? Also advocates a kind of secular liberty, freedom from religion, freedom from religious intrusion in private lives, freedom from government-sponsored religious activities. Freethinkers have been, I read your website. I saw it. Like, aha. So I want to persuade you today that we, freethinkers, gay people, and also Muslims share a common political struggle. I think that struggle, the struggle of those of us who are working for freedom from religious intrusion, and the struggle of people like Muslims who are struggling for greater religious expression, that both of these constituencies, both of these struggles, are connected to a fundamental flaw in American pluralism. How so, you might ask? Well, we imagine pluralism. Let me tell you a little bit more about how we see pluralism, how most Americans see pluralism. We imagine, kind of loudly and with fireworks, that this country has been a cradle for religious diversity. And in some ways, yes, that's the case. This religious freedom has been ensured, so the story goes, by the constitutional guarantees of the First Amendment to the Constitution, which simply states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Legal scholars have parsed out these freedoms into two. So there's, first of all, disestablishment. There can be no state-sponsored religion. And then second, there's free exercise. Individuals have the freedom to believe and practice as they will. These two constitutional guarantees, to disestablishment and to free exercise, are the bedrock of religious liberty. And they are the guarantees that make possible the kind of religious diversity that we have in this country. So given this, given this, the many ways that pluralism, that religious diversity, that religious freedom is celebrated in this country, I found it particularly troubling this fall as I was watching and listening to the debates over the Ground Zero Mosque. And it began to seem as if there was something missing in my understanding of these constitutional guarantees, that something was either maybe broken or just absent in these guarantees. I'll say more about this Ground Zero Mosque debate and what I see, what I see as the kind of, I call it absurd political theater, actually. So hang with me as I explain a little bit more about that. So this is what I was watching as I was kind of questioning how well pluralism works. Yes, watching this Ground Zero Mosque debate made me wonder, does pluralism actually work? And for me, this debate showed in stark relief that the ticket for religious freedom for American Muslims was written in disappearing ink. So if they have this ticket for religious freedom, they show up at the door, dried up, no ink, nothing. So the first thing about the debate was even just the ridiculous of the name. The Ground Zero Mosque is actually, by organizers, called Park 51. Park 51 is the address on Park Avenue where an Islamic center is being renovated, not built. The building is already there. The building is being renovated to provide the space for an Islamic center. Organizers at this center have kind of gone through cartwheels to make this project palatable. It is not a mosque. They emphatically declare it not to be a mosque. They call it a community center. There will be a a room for Friday prayers or for prayers at any time that will be available in the mosque, but most of it will be devoted to community organizing and interreligious dialogue. So that it's called a mosque is already a misnomer, and also ironic that it doesn't. One of the other things that has emerged is that there were actually were at least two prayer rooms in the Twin Towers where Muslims could meet for prayer. So this Islamic Community Center is not doing anything new, really, anything new in Lower Manhattan, and also not anything that didn't happen at the site of the Twin Towers themselves. So to call this a Ground Zero mosque is already one of the absurdities of this debate. Another absurdity is the location. Park 51 is just as close to City Hall as it is to Ground Zero. It's about two blocks from Ground Zero. And I talked with a friend of mine from Manhattan who regularly walks around in this area. And this is the financial district of New York City. She tells me that there are many things that are visible as you walk through these blocks, and they include many things that seem to maybe not adequately commemorate the souls of the departed of 9/11. They are things like track betting parlors. There's a gentleman's club. There is an Amish grocery. There's lots of stores. You know, I mean, there are many things that seem at odds with, if this is hallowed ground, they seem not sacred. This gentleman's club, right? So, I mean, even as you're walking around the blocks around Park 51, Ground Zero is actually not visible from the site of the center. And then walking around Ground Zero, the center is not visible from the site of the former Twin Towers either. So already there's, you know, why this proximity to Ground Zero is a little absurd. I'll say it. I think it's absurd. And then another thing that was troubling was the kind of invented aspect of the debate itself. The Park 51 debate arose this summer as Tea Party and other political candidates prepared for the upcoming elections. And in many ways, what they did was drum up a national platform plank out of what was essentially a local New York matter. And this New York matter had actually long ago been settled. The New York Times and Fox News ran the story about the Islamic Center in December of 2009, and it was commented on with noted approval by both sources. It wasn't until 6 months later that it became a topic of national and international debate. And as polls in Manhattan showed, the closer residents were to the mosque itself, the more likely they were to support it. So Manhattanites supported it at greater levels than people living in other boroughs of Manhattan. People in the New York boroughs tended to support it more than people in other parts of the United States. So in terms of, you know, local determination, local support was highest by people who had been most affected by 9/11 and those who were most affected by the Islamic Center itself. And yet, like, despite the way that this has been settled on the local level, this really became a national and international issue. And even though Park 51 organizers have survived this fairly intact, there's a lawsuit going on now by one of the survivors of 9/11 who is suing Park 51 for damages related to trauma that has come up after this debate. So there's that, which is, you know, and there was a lot of political back and forth in New York by candidates who were proposing different kinds of solution to where the Park 51 could be located. It seems, though, that Park 51 is going to stay where it is at Park 51 and will weather this fine. What's been more troubling, though, is that mosques and Islamic community centers in other locations have really experienced a blowback from the debate. And many community centers and mosques and locations from Staten Island to California have had their property claims challenged or canceled, their plans to build centers canceled or challenged. many American Muslims' lives and properties have been threatened or damaged. And a mosque in Tennessee was a victim of arson, and we all heard about the planned burning of the Quran here in Florida that didn't actually happen. And there was also, I've been told, a mosque in Florida that was threatened with bombing. So some real violence has come out of this debate against Muslims, even though the organizers of the Park 51 site look to be like they'll be okay. And I think the other thing I would add from that, the other thing I would add to this is the group that's involved in Park 51, another one of the absurdities, is that if we were to pick kind of upstanding, respectable Muslims, we could not do better. Imam Faisal, which is one of the organizers, and Daisy Khan, who is another organizer involved with this initiative, have ongoing interreligious connection and involvement. There are countless numbers of different initiatives that have come out of leaders and members who are involved in the Cordoba Initiative, which is one of the connected organizations, as well as the Park 51. That this is a group that's incredibly committed to educating non-Muslim Americans about Islam and incredibly committed to making viable a form of progressive Islam that they're concerned doesn't have enough traction among, you know, in global Islam. And they are also often perceived to be far more radical because of their progressive commitments to women's equality and to other ways of rethinking the form and the practice of Islam there at Park 51. So there are many Muslims who see them as way too liberal and would not be comfortable with the kind of Islam that they practice there. I'm trying to think of a good analogy. They're kind of the UCC of Islam. Right, United Church of Christ of Islam. If you can imagine a liberal Protestant denomination, they would be that within the spectrum of possibilities in Islam. So it makes it even. I'm not one to see one version of a religion or a denomination as more viable than another. But if we were to play on those terms that I don't like, this is an incredibly progressive and incredibly open-minded group of Muslims. So it's even kind of more starkly troubling that such a debate over their right to own property and their right to have the right to exist in that part of Lower Manhattan, that this would come into question. And one thing that was really interesting about the debate, going back to my question about pluralism, is that technically, formally, nobody actually questioned their right to have the Islamic Center where it was. The argument by opponents, those who were opposing this Ground Zero Mosque, they were saying largely things like this. Muslims have religious freedom, they would say, and they have the technical right to build a mosque anywhere they please. We're not denying them that right. However, the Muslims involved in this mosque ought to voluntarily abdicate their constitutional right out of deference to propriety and respect that can't be legislated. And that was mostly, you know, kind of the dominant argument that was made. The feeling was that to build an Islamic holy site so close to a site that non-Muslim Americans see as sacred, and sacred because it remembers victims who died at the hands of terrorists who claimed Islam as their, you know, as their motivation, that to have something, an Islamic holy site close to that site, was to somehow kind of defile that site and to offend those who cherished the memories of those who died there. So this was a really interesting, the standard line of the opponents to Park 51 was that America is a land of religious freedom, that they, Muslims, have the right to build a mosque where they please, and yet they, Muslims, should voluntarily let that right go, should give it up, out of a sense of propriety to those who were troubled by, you know, this site. Bill O'Reilly was one. So one of the things he repeatedly emphasized was this. Building the community center is a legal thing to do, but is it the appropriate thing to do? And the implication here was American Muslims have religious freedom. They already have it, but they should, you know, not exercise it because it's not appropriate. And here's where I wanted to ask, well, isn't the point of religious freedom to protect religious expressions that other people see as inappropriate? Placing legal rights against what's appropriate, I wasn't comfortable with that. And this seemed to be a way that, as I've said before, that for Muslims, the ink on this ticket of religious freedom disappeared the moment they tried to actually practice it. And so I've asked, well, what is it? What is it that many non-Muslim Americans find so troubling about Islam? Why is it that their visible presence is so contested? And why is it that they're so positioned as a threat to kind of American way of life and to American ideals of what is to be held sacred and holy? And one thing I think it is that Muslims are seen to be a threat to religious freedom itself. And I heard this, or I see this, in the way that anxieties about Sharia law were invoked around. One of the things that kept coming up was that Imam Faisal wanted to institute Sharia law. What was actually the case is that Imam Faisal is, well, Sharia law to begin with, like, say Sharia, and many Americans begin to picture stonings. But it's actually more appropriate to think about Sharia on the level of something like kosher. On the level of ritual practice that informs what a person is to eat, what a person, you know, daily habit, daily practice. And that is how the vast majority of Muslims relate to Sharia law, as something that informs everyday practice. But say Sharia law, and non-Muslim Americans, many of them, hear that as something that is a interloper to a kind of tyrannical interloper to American democracy. Here again, Muslims are somehow a threat to American freedom. And then other arguments come up in that you know, Muslims and Sharia law is oppressive to women. Then, of course, the anxieties that there would be terrorist networks facilitated in mosques. And again, that this conservative, fanatical religion would be antithetical to American freedom and Islam and its ties to fanaticism. Kind of this entire debate implied that Islam and its ties and its implied ties to fanaticism was a threat to the religious freedom of all Americans. So the irony is this, that the religious freedom of Muslims in this debate was curtailed in the name of American religious freedom. That because they are a threat to our freedom, therefore they should not have access to these things that would be to practice their religion freely. So that's the thing I was paying attention to, right? That that in the name of freedom, religious freedom is being curtailed by this particular religious minority. And the reason I was paying attention to that is because it made me think about another irony in the way that pluralism and religious freedom is often spoken about. And here's where I turn to the other side of this coin and think about how people who are struggling for secular freedoms, for LGBT rights and justice, for freedom from religion, are also dealing with this question of religious freedom on a different side. So I think that for Muslims, that their kind of trick ticket, as you know, their trick ticket, the ink that dries, their trick ticket for religious freedom is the other side to another ruse. And the other ruse is one that we who are fighting for religious disestablishment see pretty clearly. Because it's often, you know, often the case that despite claims to be a secular democracy, religion and especially Christianity continues to be tied up in law and government in the United States. And free thinkers are one group of people that have pushed for the other side to that trick ticket. Hold on, I have some things here that don't make sense. So in some ways, actually, let me just talk a little bit about where I see that playing out. Here's an example. There are a number of debates about whether or not there should be debates over policies that would provide employment non-discrimination for gays and lesbians, right? So one of the reasons employment laws that would protect gay, lesbian, bisexual people from discrimination on the workplace, one of the reasons why that has been opposed, is that conservative Christians and others with religious convictions against homosexuality say that this inhibits their religious freedom, that they would not be able to hire whom they please, and they would not be able to refuse employment to someone who they believed would, you know, be a bad person and would conflict with their own religious convictions. So if they, because of their religious convictions that homosexuality is wrong, would want to not hire someone who is gay or lesbian, this law would force them to, and this would threaten their religious freedom. So this is another, this is the other side of the debate. This is, on this debate over LGBT rights, it is religious freedom against people who, policies that are trying to institute freedom from religion. Maybe. You got it? I'm checking in to see if that makes sense yet. So in some ways, the debate, the coin is flipped, is what I'm trying to show. That for those who are advocating for freedom from religion, so that religion should not be administered. And another example of religion being kind of administered by the courts is until 2002, it was the law. It was still legal for states to have sodomy laws that prohibited any kind of sodomy. And one of the reasons given for that in the Supreme Court's decision on that case, before it was overturned, was that sodomy laws had roots, long-standing roots, in ancient religious codes and ancient religious traditions. And so that because of that ancient religious tradition against sodomy, it was appropriate that the law of the land could prohibit sodomy. And one of the people whose work I love, her explanation for this is that instead of justice, courts ministered religion. Instead of giving justice to LGBT people or to people who would be caught with these crimes, what the courts administered, in fact, was religion, a thou shalt not. And one of the reasons why there's been so much attention to preserving prohibitions against homosexuality has been this commitment to, well, if these laws were taken off the books, Christians would find themselves, Christians, Mormons, right, would find themselves in a position where they could no longer practice as they believe. So their claim to religious freedom would be inhibited, would be harmed. And what I see in this debate is there's kind of a betwixt and between thing here, that what gets left standing on both sides, what gets left standing in the debates over LGBT rights and justice, what gets left standing in the debates over the rights claims of religious minorities, is a dominant Protestantism. Right? And that dominant Protestantism gets to play both sides, gets to say to Muslims, you threaten our freedom, and you should not be able to practice as you will, as you have the right to. And they can say to groups that are fighting for freedom from religion, like LGBT communities, that you threaten our freedom because you're taking that secularism too far, and our right to free practice is being jeopardized. So this two sides of the coin, disestablishment and free exercise, are pitted against each other, and this dominant Protestant kind of core to American law and policies, gets to play both sides, gets to play secular disestablishment against what they see as religious extremists, and gets to play free practice against groups that are seen to be bringing in too much secularism, right? So it's here where I want to see free exercise and disestablishment as two sides to a single coin rather than things that are competitors. And I think that this becomes particularly important for groups involved in LGBT rights and justice who see what they're doing as just fighting from the imposition of religion. But I think all of us are kind of fighting for more space for more religion and more freedom to be religious and more freedom to be not religious, more freedom for religious minorities and more freedom for people who would want to practice as they will without the imposition of a particular kind of sectarian religious viewpoint. I'm seeing where I am. I'm almost done. So I'll read this little part here. Rather than seeing free exercise and disestablishment as competitors, I'm going to tell you something I already told you. Ha ha. I want to think of them as two sides to the single coin. There's a single, although nebulous, entity that wins every time religious and non-religious outsiders pit free exercise against disestablishment. And that entity is the structure of so-called secular law and government, which gets to stand as non-sectarian and non-religious, as neutral, while maintaining regulations and practices that disproportionately benefit Protestant and Protestant-looking religious establishments. The secular state operates with a kind of stealth Protestantism under the guise of non-religious secular neutrality. So the other side of the trick ticket issued to religious minorities like American Muslims is disestablishment, practiced with hands, fingers crossed behind the back. So this dominant Protestantism, I'm trying to say, issues trick tickets to religious minorities and then practices disestablishment with fingers behind the back. The struggle for disestablishment is often pitted against the other side of the coin, those who advocate for greater freedom for religious practice. And I want to say again that those of us who are invested in fighting for freedom from religion are vying with the same wily agent that is the opponent of Muslims and other religious minorities who advocate freedom for religion, the freedom to practice, to freely practice minority faiths. When these two struggles are pitted against each other, I'm convinced that neither side will benefit. Neither free thinkers, atheists, gays, nor Muslims will benefit from having their struggles, either for religious disestablishment or for free exercise, pitted against each other. The entity to benefit from such polarization will be the double agent of the so-called secular state. That is all. Now, some of that was, I welcome your questions, and I'm happy to explain or address any piece of that, please.
How we do the questions is one on this side, then one on that side, then back here again, so that everybody gets a chance. And Don's got one over there.
Okay. Unfortunately, masks are not used simply for religious reasons. The Imams have used the masks to encourage jihad and other movements. Now, we say politics is forbidden in all of our churches, and yet that is the fear here. Not that they would practice their religion, but to use that building as a place for any kind of jihad or other kind of iman projects that they have.
I would say two things to that concern. The first is kind of just a tactical, practical thing. I think that I wouldn't want to ignore that there are terrorist organizations that do claim a kind of Islam, and that those are networks that are recruiting, and those are networks that Americans and many others and Muslims themselves have every right to be concerned with. What I do think, though, is it does not shut those networks down to close down mosques. And often mosques and Islamic centers are really important antidotes to that kind of Islamic networking. Because what's happening in most mosques and in most Islamic centers is entirely the opposite of that. Those are groups that are interested in bringing communities together from different ethnic backgrounds, of collaborating on common forms of Islamic practice that is really going to be different. The thing that's unique about Islam in the United States and in Canada is that it is more ethnically diverse here than it is anywhere else in the world, because there are immigrant Muslims and African-American, white American, Latino American folks who are converting to and becoming part of Islam here in ways that is not happening elsewhere. And so there's actually a really exciting form of Islam that's being practiced, and mosques provide important spaces for that kind of Islam to come to form. And I think it's actually in the interests of Americans who are concerned about terrorism to encourage and facilitate the spaces for that kind of Islam to be practiced. And that if we respond to anxieties about terrorism by shutting down mosques, we're also shutting down really vibrant forms of Islamic practice that would counter the kind of Islam that terrorists are claiming.
Some of what you talked about reminds me of other kinds of issues the ACLU has been involved in for a generation or two. It's a principled kind of an argument which you're making and which they would make. Mm-hmm. And as an ACLU-style liberal myself, I don't see any incompatibility between the establishment and the free practice. Mm-hmm. But so many people, even a lot of liberals, are so outcome-oriented and are uncomfortable with the more abstract principled kind of issues here, mm-hmm. that it's hard to convince even liberals sometimes of what to me is just like a standard liberal position. Reminds me of the wasn't a religious issue, but when the ACLU supported the Ku Klux Klan march in Chicago, many liberals were very much opposed to the ACLU supporting the Ku Klux Klan. It's not because the ACLU is in favor of the agenda of the Ku Klux Klan, but they are in favor of a principle in which people who you disagree with have the rights to do what, from our position, may be disagreeable things. Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing seems to apply here in terms of the religious issue. Mm-hmm. That what freedom of religion means is that people who want to practice a religion, which I don't believe in, and I think is in fact bad for people and for the world, that people have a right to do it anyway. And a lot of liberals don't get that or don't see it from the same abstract principle level. Just comment on those kind of things.
I think I would just mostly say yes. I think one of the reasons why I put the issues together that I did is because I'm most concerned about liberals who see free practice of religion as something that, it concerns me that secular liberals are so threatened by the free practice of religion. That not all of them, but that opposition is often one that plays out. Liberals who have anxieties about understandable in many cases because of the political power that many conservative Christians have. But also, I think it's important to see that there are also people of faith who have just as much an investment in religious freedom. Right? So thank you for that.
Dr. White?
Yes.
I know that there is a general view among a lot of people that people in religions can't speak about political matters, but of course they do it all the time, and there's no limitation at all on any church taking a position on a political matter. If IUUs would shut down if that were the case, because there wouldn't be anything to talk about. The only attempt to limit churches in political aspects is to take positions, not to take positions for the election of one candidate over another. And even that is admired, and it's being not paid much attention to frequently in some churches. One of the complaints, though, about the Muslim presence in the country that one constantly hears is that there was no significant outcry from the Muslim population of the country about 9/11. My sense is that's simply untrue and that we weren't getting adequate reporting. I'm sure Fox would have a hard time making a major splash about a bunch of Muslims opposed to what happened. But with your specialty, perhaps you can fill us in on that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I actually take the word of friends of mine who are doing research on American Islamic Muslim communities since 9/11. And what I hear from them is that Muslim leaders in the U.S. have been doing backflips, have been working really frenetically, especially since 9/11, to do outreach and to, to speak out both against the Islam that they saw claimed by terrorism and to do work on behalf of their communities so that Americans have a better understanding of what they see as the true Islam, which, well, one of the things that you'll hear over and over again is that Islam at its root, oh dear, now I don't remember how exactly it goes, surrender to peace. Anyway, interestingly enough, the Arabic word for peace, I don't remember exactly, not being an Arabic scholar, I don't remember exactly how the comment goes, but the Arabic word for peace is linked to the word for Islam. And so there are most Muslims see working for peace as the core of what their faith is about. And so I do think that it's really indicative that even a group like the Park 51 folks who have been, I don't know if there's a group that has done more to do outreach up to, you know, non-Muslim Americans, that even this group could be painted as extremist, says to me a lot about the troubling, the lack of responsible reporting, really.
My problem with religion, mm-hmm. and then Muslim in particular, is when practices of that religion seem to go against our safety. Mm-hmm. Like, example, burqas. And face coverings, mm-hmm. and so forth, that are, to my knowledge, religious dictum for the people covering women. I don't believe anybody's face should be covered because of the safety of the public. Mm. I don't believe the burqas, a man could be wearing it and being a terrorist, mm-hmm. and so forth. You can cover your head because it lets your face. So I'd like you to discuss the inconsistencies between the freedom that I see, mm-hmm. and the freedom that I believe people should have when they practice their religion, but not when it gets goes against the safety of the entire society.
Mm-hmm. There have been a number of I should say that there are various kinds of head coverings head or body coverings in Islam, and the burqa is the full body covering. There's a face covering called the knee, don't remember the name of it, and then the hijab, which is the covering of the hair. And there have been a number of different court cases here, and particularly in Europe, court cases and laws and debates over what kinds of things Muslim women can wear, what kinds of freedoms they have, either to, you know, to wear hijab, to cover the face, to cover the whole body. And, Well, and then to add to that, the other religious garment that has been brought up as a security concern is the sheikh head wrapping, which there's been a number of recent Sikhs are here I am, religion scholar, pronouncing things wrong. So not Muslim, but that's a garment that is often associated with Islam, right? So there are security measures in place at airports for how to deal with head wrappings, how to deal with face coverings, and there few Muslims can get away. I would say that I would be more concerned, the court cases over. I mean, there's my worry is that the anxiety over things like the hijab or things like the burqa actually go pretty far on the other side. That there have been regulations against women wearing the headscarf, wearing hijab, getting their driver's license photos taken wearing hijab. So their face would be showing, but there have been women who haven't been able to get their driver's license because they would have to take the head covering off. From that to women seeking employment who wear hijab who have not been able to find jobs, have experienced employment discrimination because employers don't want to hire someone who wears hijab. So I don't think I'll say anything definitively on that other than to each of these questions bears scrutiny on its own, and I think it's important to really ask what is the threat, what are the real issues involved, and can we kind of neutralize some of what comes off as a bit of hysteria or even just anxiety that can be disproportionate. So I do understand the concern about having someone go through security check with a full face covering, a ski mask would be just as troubling, right? So what kinds of policies can be put in effect to deal with the kind of genuine implications of those security concerns, and can we take out some of the ways that there's, because it's connected to Islam, there's additional anxiety about it that isn't as warranted. So I hope that helps. And I see another hand up.
I have a question myself, actually.
All right.
why is Islam growing so fast in America at a time mm-hmm. when other churches are losing members like mm-hmm. crazy? I mean, what's the appeal? Mm-hmm. Is this a young person's thing?
Yeah. I can only offer kind of hints on that. And one of the books to read on that question is called Mecca and Main Street. It's by a woman named Genevieve Abdo. Her last name is A-B-D-O, Mecca and Main Street. And it's on Islam in America, another really wonderful readable book. And what's that? Okay. Oh, fantastic. I'm so glad to hear you're here. I think that there's a lot of attention to Islam right now, and so there are a lot of people interested in it. Yeah. Some of the conversion rates are coming from really interesting places, like American Latinos. And I think that they're some of the things that individuals talk about that gets them interested in Islam is in some cases disenchantment with a Christianity that they come from. And some of it is also concern that, one of the troubling things to many people about Christianity is that there's a claim that God is one, and yet then there's Jesus and Holy Spirit. So there are kind of theological wrestlings within Christianity that have resolution within Islam. And some people find a home there because of that. And then there are also, demographic stuff that I wouldn't be able to give a full answer to. And I would actually really be interested in what you would have to say about your perception of conversions to Islam. Can I hand it up? You have a microphone.
Thank you very much. Do you want me to stand up?
Sure.
Actually, I spoke in this church about 3-4 years ago introducing Islam. And as the Dr. White said, for the last 8-9 years, I've been extremely busy talking in churches, synagogues, clubs, you name it, talking, introducing Islam. And I really am extremely, I lived about 40 years, 46 years in the West between England and America. So I don't know whether I'm an Arab or Westernized, one of the two, somewhere in between. My wife is English for the last 40 years and I'm happy with her. She's still Christian, I'm still a Muslim. That tells you there's no compulsion in Islam. I will not force her, it's up to her. When people turn to Islam, they do not become Muslim for me because I talk about Islam or for anybody else. It's relation between themselves and God. I don't get any credit for it, they get the credit for it. Now the last question we had about the first, why do people convert to Islam? We had many people convert in Sarasota. You know, they come in, they study Islam, and most of them, they study deeply religious, different religions. You know, they go to Buddhist, they go to Hinduism, they go to Judaism, they go to whatever it is, they are Christians, and they come to convert to Islam. The best thing is you can ask one of them why they do it. And most of them, they say, I found peace of spirituality, peace of myself in Islam, in the facts which are in the Quran. What I really found as well, that many people talk about Islam and they know nothing about Islam, only what they heard on the television. You know, about answering the question about the hijab, Mary, peace be upon her, the mother of Jesus had a hijab. Mary, the mother of Jesus, had a head covering. Yeah, hang on a second, you see. We're talking about tradition, see. The Catholic nuns have covering. The people in Greece have covering. The people in Italy have covering. The Christians in all the Middle East, 90% of the Middle East, have got hair covering. So that's a choice of a woman and a respect for religion. It's not by force.
I'm talking about face covering, not hair covering.
Well, you mean the one they put like that? That is a tradition. That tradition came to us from the Gulf. Okay? Yeah, I'm against it. But, you know, the hair covering and the hijab is totally different and it's human freedom. Talking about the jihad, ma'am, the jihad, to answer your question, this is the most misunderstood statements that they make on the television today. The word jihad by itself means struggle against yourself to improve yourself in this world. To improve your manner, your behavior, your attitude, to be good to your neighbors, to look after your neighbors, to look after your family, to look after your parents. That is what jihad is. But it starts with struggle against yourself to improve yourself from the minute you wake up. And of course, you know, the word jihad means struggle. And somehow the scholars on the television media, they love this word and they dish it out. They want jihadists. They are jihadists. You know, within the struggle, our boys in Iraq are struggling, the army. Our boys in Afghanistan struggling. Our army is struggling somewhere else to achieve something. And in Islam, the word jihad, we say they are jihading. They are making jihad to improve themselves or to improve whatever they are there for. So Muslims as well have got the word jihad to improve themselves and equally to defend themselves against anybody who might come and invade them or attack them or abuse them or rape their wives or kill their children, what have you. This itself is called jihad too. So the word jihad is to improve yourself first against anything that might corrupt you. My wife will tell you that. Thank you very much.
We're going to go back to the questions. I have a question right
here. I would want to add, for people from a Christian background, I think it's helpful to compare the Muslim concept of jihad to sanctification, if that is something familiar. So sanctification as also a practice of kind of struggle with the self and purification and becoming better is a useful analogy for how to better understand jihad than, you know, the ways that it's been connected to militarism. Yes, hi.
Dr. White. You talked about Sharia law and how its relationship to people's individual practices and their here, especially here. As a feminist, could you talk about Sharia law as it seems to be an underpinning for dominant, you know, for some oppression of women in other countries. You know, countries like Saudi Arabia that we know.
Sure.
Could you talk about that as a feminist?
Yeah, well, let me answer that in one of the courses I'm teaching this semester is called Women in Religion. And that's exactly the kind of thing we're looking at, is the place and the role of women within a variety of religious traditions that have roots in cultures where men have been dominant over women, that have some laws and regulations that have instituted that power dynamic over women. The answer I would give to that is that I would want to place women's struggle and women's negotiation of Islamic law and teachings in conversation with how women in Christianity, women in Judaism, and women in other traditions also kind of negotiate with patriarchal pasts and also breathe new life into their traditions, because I don't think that any religion can be solidified in time as a thing, that, you know, the meaning of tradition or the practice of tradition is always and continually changing. And so what laws and practices have meant in the past are also things that are always being reinterpreted. And this is being done just as much by groups that we would call progressive as groups that we would see as really conservative. That change over time is inevitable. And even those who are kind of most fiercely attached to a certain notion of tradition are instituting changes in order to put that into place. I think what I would want to say the most about that is that there's not enough attention paid to the many ways, for example, that Muslim women wear hijab. Many, if not most, young women in the United States who start wearing hijab, especially if they're second generation, do so not because their parents tell them to, but because they choose to do that against parents who are often more interested in assimilating, right? And so wearing hijab is often something that's seen as an embrace of a Muslim identity, in some ways a political identity in a culture where identity is already politicized because Islamic or Muslim identity has been made something pejorative. So in a way that's sort of similar from my perspective to movements for black power or movements of other kinds of ethnic identity, Chicano, Irish, you know, what have you, like other ways of embodying practices that embrace an ethnic identity. I think that women in Islam also take up hijab for that practice. So it's really complicated. And I would want to, you know, there's a lot of space for negotiation within a tradition. Yes?
I have really two subjects. One is to remind everybody that when we talk about Islam or any other religion, mm-hmm. that there's a strong interaction between the religion itself, mm-hmm. the culture in which it is practiced, yeah. or in the case of Islam, all the world, mm-hmm. in different spots, and the politics that are involved. And so it's very difficult to say something about Islam if you ignore the politics and the culture. The second one is a more academic thing in your discussion. You talked about the freedom of religion to do certain practices. Sometimes those practices are against the civil law, and that transition between the religious freedom and the civil requirements is often a very difficult one. Talk would help from an introduction of that as a discussion item.
I think what I would say to that is that there are any, well, one of the, to take that question, the question of what if someone wants to do something because of their religious convictions that's also against the law of the state? This happens all the time. Including things as neutral, seemingly neutral, as there's a huge court case in Boca Raton. There's a book written about it called The Impossibility of Religious Freedom. And the court case was the cemetery had instituted a new practice of forbidding vertical monuments. All monuments had to be flat. And so religious groups that came in, either they hadn't, and for a long time they hadn't, they hadn't enforced it. So there were a lot of crosses, there were a lot of statues, there were a lot of, and so there was a huge court case. And the deciding factor here over whether or not, you know, individuals could have these vertical monuments that were against the policy of the cemetery was whether or not the state had an interest, or in this case, the cemetery had an interest, an overriding interest in this regulation. And if that was proven to be the case, then that, again, interest would override, you know, the religious freedom claims. And in that case, the cemetery did win the lawsuit, and it was decided that they had an overriding interest that, you know, it's kind of a funny case. They had an overriding interest. Monuments had to be flat, you know, statues had to go away. But that also happens, like, there were cases of Native American use of peyote. That's an illegal substance, so there were court cases over whether or not Native Americans could consume a ritual drug. If that was, you know, if they had the right to do that or if that was against the law. And the question always is this: does the state have an overriding interest? And that's determined case by case.
I actually have a question more about when you talk about Protestantism. Mm-hmm. I think you're lumping an awfully large group.
Right.
And I have a real problem when they refer fundamentalists mm-hmm. or they refer themselves as Christians, as mm-hmm. if they were the only ones.
Yeah.
And to me, to lump all Protestants in one bucket mm-hmm. is an issue, because mm-hmm. I grew up in a very liberal Protestant religion, you know, where and not to say you're wrong about mm-hmm. there is certainly the influence of Protestantism in the government from day one,
right.
But I think there are a lot of Protestants who are not mm-hmm. in your in this
yes.
bucket. And that's all. You know.
Point well taken. Yes. I think more what I'm trying to think about is a way that religion as a generic category is claimed by particular sectarian groups. And as one example of that, you've all probably heard of the court battle over the Ten Commandments that were posted in a court in South Carolina. The judge there claimed, well, because of my Judeo-Christian inheritance and the Judeo-Christian inheritance of the American nation, it is appropriate for me to have a Ten Commandments posted on the wall of my courtroom. Interestingly enough, I think what this judge didn't know is that there are three different versions of the Ten Commandments. Catholics have a version, Jews have a version, Protestants have a version. His version was Protestant. And yet, he was claiming Judeo-Christian as something that his particular sectarian attachment to that document represented. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to get at, the way that if you scratch some of what we think of as generically religious or generically, sort of generically Judeo-Christian, that a lot of the power behind that is coming from conservative Protestant groups that are claiming something larger than what they are.
I have a couple of questions for you. An observation that I have made among Unitarians is that occasionally, and I remember a good friend down in Venice when we were having a discussion once, said that he was really a staunch Unitarian, but he was still bothered from his Catholic upbringing that he was beginning to think maybe there was no afterlife. And and so I'm wondering if part of the appeal of Islam is that I'm a neophyte in learning about Islam. I've been reading a lot in the last few weeks, but it seems to me to have a logical parts to it that just makes sense. And to those people that might be logical and looking for things that make sense but still have this wishing for some religious part of it too, it may make the most sense to them. Does that seem sensible?
Well, and I would add to that, if any of you have not read the Quran, my students are always shocked at what's not in the Quran. Because if you're familiar with the Christian and Jewish Bibles, it reads very similarly to the Psalms. It's poetry. And many parts of it, especially if especially listening to the chanted in Arabic, it's beautiful. And so I think that there's a kind of simplicity, perhaps, in Islam. I mean, I would be speaking for other people and their attraction, but I do find that the simplicity and the poetry that I see in Islamic practice is very, very compelling. Yeah, and I think that there's not enough that's a part of it that a lot of non-Muslim folks are not really aware of. And it's worth, I think, for all of us to kind of acquaint ourselves with more of the Quran and more of the practice of the tradition. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess just one last thought about that particular question is that some of the other religions have such beliefs that don't seem credible, that it hurts the belief in the other parts of it, even though they're good parts.
Yeah.
The second one, about something you said earlier about people feeling threatened that they're not allowed to practice their own religion because of things like Islam. Mm-hmm. I was listening to the radio one night in my car, and there were two fundamentalist religious preachers talking to each other. And you could see that they really were sincerely frightened of what they thought was going to be the imposition on them to act as preachers in marrying people, because they thought that this argument against requiring a marriage only between a woman and a man was going to bring lawsuits against them if they refused to marry two men or two women. And I'd like to think that there's an answer to that, but I guess one thing I've heard is that most gay people said that they would have no interest in bringing a lawsuit. But maybe there isn't a little bit of a negative aspect to this. Things are not always good and bad. Maybe, do you think that there could be a problem with preachers being...
Yeah, no, because ministers can refuse to marry people for any reason whatsoever. And there are many, like priests in the Catholic tradition, for example, can refuse to marry people who are not both Catholic. It has long been the case in Catholicism and Protestantism. Not, you know, there are churches today. my brother and his wife went to marriage counseling at my parents' church, and there were four rules that the pastor laid out for it. If they met these four rules, they could be married. And I'm not going to remember all of them, but one of them was that they couldn't have had sex before they were married. They couldn't have lived together. They had to have known each other for at least 6 months, and they had to both be Christians, right? And if that minister had said, no, I'm not going to marry you, there's nothing, no law that can force that minister to marry someone who wants to be married by them. So ministers can and do refuse to conduct ceremonies for all kinds of reasons. And the idea that they would be forced to hold same-sex ceremonies doesn't hold water. Yeah. Yes.
Recovering Catholic here, now an atheist. Can you tell me, in your slightly afield, but in your research into this whole area of religion, religious belief and practice,
mm-hmm.
do people who are a member of Islamic, I always screw up the verb there, is it as easy for somebody practicing Muslim, do they leave for the same reason? Do they abandon their church and end up at Freethinkers for the same reason Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Wiccans do? Is it very parallel, or are there differences of behavior and erosion of belief in moving towards sanity? And I admit the last sentence is editorial.
To get the answer to that question, one would have to do a kind of demographic, a survey, an interview survey of people who had transitioned out of their religion of origin into free thinkers or humanists. So I don't know what, you know, if we were to look kind of en masse at reasons that people leave Islam and what that looks like in comparison to people who leave Catholicism or people who leave Protestantism. I would recommend this book, actually, The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf, because that is an interesting book about someone who grows into a really different understanding of her tradition than she grew up with. And I do think that there is something about that kind of story, children who grow up in a tradition and negotiate different ways of living with it, that happens. I mean, I don't want to say that's universal, but I would say that that's really, really common. And just hearing those individual stories, I think, may give some context to the question about what it would be like coming out of a different tradition other than the one that you're familiar with. So it's kind of stories across those different
okay.
traditions.
Maybe we should leave it at that.
I'm sorry?
Peer pressure.
Yeah.
Peer pressure.
Yeah, I mean, that's another piece that makes a lot of sense, that there's a different kind of cultural pressure from the outside on Muslims than there are on Catholics or Protestants. I mean, for Protestants and Catholics, they don't have to deal with the same kind of pejorative view of outsiders of their faith. So I'm sure that there are things that must be unique. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor, for coming. And
thank you all. It was a pleasure to speak with you.